This is Law and Disorder.
Imagine if your child got a full scholarship to study abroad, was kidnapped in the middle of a final exam, imprisoned, tortured, and then brought back to the United States and convicted on the basis of that torture-induced confession. It happened to Ahmed Omar Abu Ali. He got 30 years in prison. Listen to his sister, who's joining us today, tell about what this case has been all about for her family.
Sadly, his case is not the only case. Under the current administration, evidence, confessions, whatever people say under torture, is used against them at trials in this country and at military bases around the world.
We were joined by an attorney for the Uyghur Muslims in Guantanamo Bay. They were found innocent at a military tribunal but couldn't go back to China, wouldn't be let into the U.S., and just languishing at Guantanamo. Hear the amazing update.
Amazing update, to put it mildly. All of a sudden, the attorneys get notified that their clients have been sent to Albania. Why? Listen and hear the reason.
Anthony Arnove will be joining us to talk about his new book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal.
If you're doubting that we should get out of Iraq immediately, Anthony will put those doubts to rest. Get out of Iraq now. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
On Law and Disorder, we've been following the case of Ahmed Omar Abu Ali. Listeners will remember that this is the American student who went to Saudi Arabia to study, was kidnapped, tortured by the Saudis, and finally brought back to the United States. He was returned to the U.S., and then now he had to face trial here for confessions that were produced allegedly under torture. He had scars on his body and suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, consistent with someone who is tortured. He described torture by the Saudi authorities that is entirely consistent with well-recorded investigations of torture under Saudi interrogation and detention. The U.S. State Department reports confirm that this type of torture is standard. That evidence that he was tortured was not admitted into the courtroom. And this spring, he was sentenced to 30 years in federal prison. Today, we'll talk with his sister, Tasneem Abu Ali, who's still trying to get her brother out. Tasneem Abu Ali, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Tasneem, we've been following the case of your brother here on Law and Disorder for many months. Can you catch listeners up if they haven't been following with us? Can you just tell us a little bit about the case?
Sure. My brother was arrested while he was taking his final exams at the University of Medina. He was studying there on a full scholarship, and Saudi security officers came into the classroom and arrested him. This was in 2003. After that, for 2 months, we didn't hear from my brother, and of course, we started to become very worried about him. Requests to the Saudis and to U.S. officials didn't really bring us any answers. And after really a whole year of waiting and worrying, we decided to file suit in the District of Columbia, and we filed a habeas corpus requesting his release from Saudi detention. We also alleged that the U.S. government was involved in his arrest and detention.
What made you think that?
What made us think that is that we knew that FBI officials were either directly interrogating him or watching his interrogation by Saudi officials. And we knew this from a couple of sources, including the media who reported about my brother's case. Also, U.S. officials gave us some information about that. Saudi officials were saying that they really didn't want to detain my brother, was it not for the U.S. government's request, and they were willing to release him if the U.S. government gave a green light for that. After we filed a habeas suit...
Oh, 1 second on that, because, you know, this is Michael Ratner again. I remember reading the papers when you filed them, and there was not only the allegation that he was really being kept at the behest of the United States and they really controlled his freedom, but also there was an allegation that he was being abused and tortured. Is that right?
Yes. What really made us concerned is that U.S. officials were watching my brother's interrogation by Saudi officials, and they would just watch behind a glass panel as the Saudis were interrogating him. You know, the Saudis' record in abusing detainees. And it just made us very worried, the U.S. government's secrecy.
Saudi Arabia has a terrible record. It's on the Amnesty webpage, Amnesty International webpage. Their rate of getting confessions is astronomical. The type of torture they use is really pretty consistent with the type of torture that has been alleged in this case.
Yes. Once it came time for a trial and the Saudis who had interrogated my brother testified, one of the things that they said is that we have a 100% success rate in getting confessions out of detainees. And obviously, if they have a 100% success rate, that means that the detainees really have no will in the process. Also, the Saudis who testified in my brother's case, they testified under pseudonyms. Not even the attorneys for my brother knew what their real names were. And my brother didn't know what their real names were because they never revealed that information to him, obviously, while they were interrogating him. That was one of the many things in my brother's case, many decisions on the judge's part that hampered, you know, the defense's efforts to kind of reveal more about Saudi Arabia's record of abuse, because obviously if they had those names, they would have done background investigations, tried to find out if there were other victims out there who were willing to speak in my brother's case and testify.
Well, Tiznay, we jumped a step. Can you talk to us about your brother, after you filed the habeas, your brother was brought back to the U.S.?
Yeah, what happened is after we filed the habeas, like the cases in Guantanamo Bay, the government was arguing that the U.S. courts did not have jurisdiction over the subject matter, and that even if my brother was being detained under, you know, the direct request of the U.S. government, that didn't mean that the courts could do anything about it. They never denied that they had involvement in my brother's case and his detention.
But he was brought back here and charged.
Yeah. The judge, thankfully, he did not buy that argument, and he ordered a discovery process for the habeas case, and he ordered that the government reveal records and information about my brother's arrest and detention. Directly after that, the U.S. government decided to bring my brother back home.
We actually followed, on Law and Disorder, we followed the case while it was happening. And the sad conclusion, unfortunately, I was in the courtroom.
Well, we have skipped a step.
Oh.
I mean, as you said, Judge Bates was the orders there be discovery in the case. And then rather than go through with discovery, which would have shown the U.S. hand in what went on in Saudi Arabia, they bring your brother back to the United States and they indict him. Is that right?
Yes.
And what was the indictment for?
It was on several counts. One of them was providing material support to Al-Qaeda, conspiracy to assassinate the President of the United States. We were very, very shocked by the charges. In the 20 months that my brother was detained, not one U.S. official alluded to anything resembling these kind of offenses. And in fact, you know, U.S. officials at one point were saying, We have no further interest in his detention. One of the U.S. officials that we were in touch with, his name is Mason, Michael Mason. He is the assistant director of FBI, of the FBI in Washington. And he had sent email to one of our friends, our family friends, saying this office no longer has an interest in Ahmed Abu Ali's detention.
Now, when they brought him back, they charged him with this, and the main evidence against him was his so-called confession. Is that right?
Yes.
And that's the confession, of course, that he says was undertaken by torture. So can you describe that, what he said happened to him?
Yes. On the first day that my brother came back, he said to the judge, "I was tortured." He also informed his attorneys that he had been whipped on his back, that he had been shackled days at a time, that, you know, he had been deprived of sleep, of going to the bathroom even.
All common torture techniques around the world, but particularly in Saudi Arabia, very consistent with what we know to be true.
Yes. I mean, in the State Department Human Rights report, you know, whipping is reported as a method that the Saudis use. And it's just, like you said, a standard practice in Saudi Arabia. The problem was that the judge let in this confession, and the whole case was just built on that confession.
Right. The rule is that you can't use evidence that comes as the result of torture, obviously.
Yes.
But in this case, the judge said, well, I'm going to disregard that. I'm going to say essentially that he wasn't tortured. He had to make that finding and let the evidence in.
There was physical evidence on his body. There was a physician who was extensively experienced with torture victims who examined my brother, examined his back, examined the marks, and he concluded that he had been whipped. He was also examined by a psychologist who also had treated torture victims in the context of asylum cases. And she as well concluded that my brother had a psychological symptoms of torture, that he had symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, very common amongst torture survivors.
It went to the jury with them having the confession that was the result of torture, and they convicted him, obviously. They had the confession. And at that point, he was sentenced to how many years?
He was sentenced to 30 years.
And where is he in prison now?
Right now, he's being held in Alexandria.
Is there an appeal that you're going to do from this?
Yes. Currently, attorney Joshua Dreitel is handling the appeal. They're still reviewing the papers.
So you'll be appealing, and you'll hope for the best on that, I gather.
This has got to change. I mean, something really, we have to wake up in America. It has gotten so bad that we are allowing people who have been tortured abroad to come back to the United States or be brought back to the United States. And we're using those confessions against them. This is not an isolated case. This is the beginning of a trend. We're talking about this every week on our show in one context or another. Go back into our archives on lawanddisorder.org and listen to the Mohamed Salah cases. We have two shows, one on March 26th, I believe, and one on November 7th. Go back and listen to what happened. It's very similar to what happened here. These are like cousin cases. If we start allowing people to be tortured abroad and brought back here to the United States and trying them on the basis of the torture-induced confessions, our entire system of law and our last shreds of decency will have disappeared. Tell us what we can do to help.
I also, you know, when we use the word confession, a lot of people think maybe if, you know, they tortured him bad enough, then maybe he confessed to the truth. That's not really the case because, for example, in my brother's case, what they did was they wrote a confession for him in their own words, writing down a sequence of events that my brother had nothing to do with, and they came to him and they said, copy this. And after he copied it in his own hand, they made him read it in front of a video camera. And that was what was called his confession. Also, it came after 45 days of interrogation. I mean, in America, we're not even supposed to be held one day without being allowed to speak to an attorney. If in my brother's case, it was 45 days of detention with sleepless nights, without being allowed to go to the restroom. they even assigned him a number, and they would frequently knock on his jail door and just call out that number just to keep him awake all day long. And just all sorts of psychological and physical abuse that persisted for 45 days until they got him to write down that confession and copy it.
People shouldn't have a hard time understanding what torture can do. And you don't have to look that far to see why torturing someone or mistreating someone will result in an immediate confession to absolutely anything. Look at your kids. If you have more than one child in your house, then at some point or another, you have certainly seen one kid get on top of the other kid and twist their arm saying, you know, tell me I'm the king. Tell me I'm the king. No, no, you're not the king. Tell me I'm the king. And that kid then says, you're the king, says anything the dominant child wants them to say. Imagine if you are being hit with a whip. Imagine if you are being deprived of sleep. What would you confess to then?
What can we tell our listeners to do about this case? What are you suggesting people do?
I think if listeners wrote to, you know, their officials, to congressmen, to senators, expressing concern about this case, expressing concern that this might happen to any American studying abroad or traveling abroad, that a foreign government might arrest us while we're abroad and we have no safety or security and no guarantees of protection from our own government. I mean, that's very chilling to me, and it should be chilling to every American.
It should be upsetting that it could happen to anybody, but it should also be upsetting that it happened to somebody. Tasneem Abuali, our sympathies and our solidarity with you and your family. We are looking at this case. We're looking at the Mohamed Salah case in Chicago, a similar case, and we're really going to work towards a good result. Please look at lawanddisorder.org, all of our listeners, for updates. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Dali.
Thank you,
Tasneem.
Thank you.
For the past several years, innocent Uyghur Muslims have been held at Guantanamo Bay. They have had nowhere else to go.
Uyghur cases are pretty outrageous. They were picked up probably in Pakistan. They were an ethnic minority from China. China, if they were sent back, would torture them. For a couple of years, the U.S. has known that they were innocent of any charges.
Neil McGarrigan has been working with Sabin Willett at Bingham McCutcheon, a law firm in Boston, to represent the Uyghur Muslims. Just recently, they were let out of Guantanamo and dumped into Albania, where they have no family, no contacts, don't speak the language, just dumped, once again, by the U.S. government.
But the U.S. has refused to give them asylum in the United States, which is obviously where they should go. And instead, after huge court pressure from Neil and others you're going to hear from, they were sent, as Dahlia said, unceremoniously to Albania. I think at this moment we'll have to ask Neil, but Sabin Willett has actually gone to Albania to try and figure out what he can do for them. The Uyghurs really are emblematic of what Guantanamo is all about, picking up people anywhere in the world, holding them without charges and without trial, and then giving them finally some kind of little rump military trial, which in this case, actually, they couldn't prove anything. And in most of the other cases, they haven't proved very much, if anything. And that's what we have in Guantanamo, which is why we, at the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is coordinating many of these cases, have insisted that there be charges and trials, or that everyone should be released. Right now, of course, the world is pushing for the closing down of Guantanamo.
Go to our website, lawanddisorder.org, and go to our show on January 2nd. You can listen to our first segment on the Uyghur Muslims back when they were held in Guantanamo. We talked with Sabin Willett, who is their attorney, who's currently in Albania with them, to figure out what their next steps are. Meanwhile, we have here with us Neil McGarrigan, an attorney at Bingham McCutcheon, who works with Sabin Willett and has been working on the case of the Uyghur Muslims who were held for so long at Guantanamo Bay. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much for having me.
Neil, you're here with Michael Smith, a lawyer in New York, Dahlia Hashad, who you know is from Amnesty International,
yeah,
Heidi Boghossian from the National Lawyers Guild, and me from the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Oh,
I'm proud to be in such esteemed company.
Well, we're proud to be with you, who've been representing the Uyghurs for a long time.
Yeah, it's going on more than a year now, actually.
So why don't you tell us what's the latest thing that happened to your clients?
We got a call from the Department of Justice alerting us to be on the lookout for a motion to dismiss our client's appeal because they were already in Albania.
Take a step back and tell us, because for those who aren't following this case, tell us a little bit about the case.
Sure. The clients I'm referring to are two men named Abu Bakr Qasim and Adil Al-Hakim, and they are Uyghur men, had been in Guantanamo for just about 4 years and were in their fifth year in total in U.S. custody. They had been picked up in Pakistan, where they, as we understand it, were sold by Pakistani bounty hunters for $5,000 each, along with a group of some 16 other Uyghurs. They were in a small group of people at Guantanamo who were determined by the U.S. military to be non-combatant, you know, meaning essentially that even the U.S. military agreed they had never been part of for supporting al-Qaeda or the Taliban or taken up arms against the U.S. or any of its allies. So these guys, the U.S. conceded, were picked up really by mistake. But the U.S. government couldn't return them to China because of fears of what might happen to them back in China. There's a long history of pretty brutal repression of the Uyghur people by the communist Chinese government. So they were stuck in limbo in Guantanamo. We finally got a federal judge to rule on the merits of their case, and he issued what is, as far as we can tell, a decision that's really the first in the history of American jurisprudence that the executive had unlawfully detained our clients and that the ongoing and continuing detention of our clients was unlawful, but that a federal court had no power to tell the executive to release them, in other words, to remedy the unlawful detention. So we appealed that decision, and that's the appeal that was pending that I mentioned the government moved to dismiss.
And you had no notice at all of the transfer?
We had no notice at all. No, we'd never heard of that. I'm not sure that anybody or many people in Albania had any notice either. It seems that there was some confusion, actually, upon the men's arrival in Albania, and it wasn't entirely clear to us that anybody there even knew they were coming.
Now, one reason, I presume, that they did this was to get rid of the appeal, is what it sounds like.
I think that's the exclusive reason that they did this.
In whose custody were they sent to?
They are in Albanian custody. They have filed asylum petitions with the Albanian government. They are in a asylum seeker detention center in Tirana.
Who filed the asylum petitions for them? I don't understand.
Well, you mentioned a bit ago that Sabin Willett reported that essentially when they stepped off the plane, they were handed these asylum papers and said, you need to sign these if you expect to stay here. So they signed asylum petitions, and they've been submitted. And
asylum from whom? The U.S. government or China?
Well, it's asylum from China, I think, is probably the accurate way to put it. But they are now petitioning for asylum in Albania.
And they're in prison during this time, or in custody, or what?
It's probably not fair to call it prison. It is a compound of sorts, and it's walled, and I don't understand them to have the freedom to come and go. But it's probably not quite what most of us would think of as a prison. They live in a four-room apartment and have, you know, virtual freedom inside the compound, but a difficulty getting in and out, I think.
Now, did either of these people have families?
They both have families, children, spouses, parents, for the most part, back in China. Both of them have children they've never seen because they were born after they were picked up in Pakistan.
And what's going to happen to the families now?
We don't know. It's something that both of the men have been very cautious of all along and have asked us not to, you know, contact their families in China for fear that the authorities there might, you know, take action. But it's we don't know really what will happen to their families. We assume they'll stay in China for now.
Now, I don't know if you can discuss this, but when Sabin saw them in Albania, how are they feeling? What are they thinking? I mean, are they really, I mean, what are they supposed to do now?
What are they supposed to do now is a good question. I mean, I think they were initially quite relieved to have been released from Guantanamo. I think the relief faded pretty quickly when they saw where they were. And, you know, Albania is a terribly depressed country, and it is in very difficult economic straits, high degree of unemployment, essentially crumbling sort of former Soviet country, the chances of a successful integration into society there appear to be next to nothing. There are, as far as we can tell, no Uyghurs in Albania, nobody who speaks Uyghur, nobody who shares any real cultural similarity to our clients. So I think that the initial feeling of relief at having been released from Guantanamo has deteriorated quite rapidly into one of some considerable fear about what might happen if asylum petitions are actually granted.
Why were they sent to Albania, do you think?
I don't know. You know, we understood from court filings that the government had made over the course of the last year that it had been trying to find some host country to accept them in and hadn't been able to agree on acceptable terms.
Neil, was there any chance that they could have been brought to the U.S. and then have sought asylum here? Is that why taking them to Albania was to avoid that?
That was certainly a possible outcome of the appeal. You know, we had sought that relief in the district court and asked that they be brought to the United States at least while their permanent status was worked out. The government would never agree to that, although it never gave us a reason why.
They're going to want them in a place where they can communicate with anyone to talk to them about the horrors that the U.S. government has put them through for the past 5 years. Guantanamo is a black hole not only of law, but of communication. And things so horrible are happening down there that we are never supposed to hear about it in this country. It makes me so mad what's happening to everybody.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. They know what sort of how much information the men might have about Guantanamo. But the other part of it is I think that there is a real genuine fear on the part of the U.S. government that if you release two men into U.S. Society and everybody sees what charming, sweet, decent, and good human beings they are, the myth that Guantanamo holds only terrorists and facilitators of terror and bomb makers falls apart. And that myth is so integral to this administration's worldview that it can't afford to have anybody start to see who's really at Guantanamo.
I think that's right. When you hear Rumsfeld say that they're the worst of the worst and still insist on it today,
right,
that we have terrorists at Guantanamo, and then you see these two young Uyghur men, I think that myth is put to the lie. I also am just amazed by the case. Here are these two guys in Pakistan minding their own business, sold to the United States, wind up 4 years in Guantanamo, and then wind up with the rest of their life in Albania while their families are in China? I mean, it's...
Let's say that their asylum petition is allowed and they are released to the streets of Albania. I'm not so sure how much fortitude the Albanian government has and how strong and able it is to stand up to what appears to be very strong Chinese pressure to have them repatriated to China.
Wow.
That's one of the scariest things for us right now, that they just aren't safe. Even if they could pull off a miracle and integrate into Albanian society, it doesn't seem like it's a remotely safe place for them to be.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable fear given the relations between those two countries in the past. Neil, let me ask you one question on a personal note. Sabin was really eloquent in telling us what it was that drew him into this kind of litigation, coming from his kind of background and the sort of firm that you guys have. What was it that drew you into this case?
I don't know what Sabin's exact motivation was, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's something similar. I mean, at the time we got involved, which was I think March of last year, it had been in the press for so long that what was going on in Abu Ghraib and what was going on in Guantanamo and the idea that this was my government, essentially a reflection of me doing this, not just in far away overseas, but right here 70 miles off the coast of Florida, really got to me and made me feel that if there was anything I could do to be a part of sort of showing that that's not what American values and not what democracy in this country are about, it was something I wanted to be involved in. So I was very eager to jump on board. I have to say it was Sabin who brought it to my attention that it was an opportunity that this firm was going to be involved in. But once he mentioned it, I was game because it was time to get involved.
Tell us, how can listeners help?
I think that being informed is always really helpful, and keeping on top of issues like this. You know, one of the things that has been most effective from our standpoint since the courts have been virtually useless is really public pressure. And I think staying on top of this in local editorials, talking out about it in various civic groups, and writing to anyone and everyone about this situation is probably the most critical thing that could happen.
Neil, this is great work. I mean, really appreciated by all of us, and a remarkable case I know you guys are going to stay with it until you really obtain serious freedom for your client. So thank you very much from all of us.
Neil McGarren of Bingham McCutcheon, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And please tell Sabin we all say hello.
Of course, I will do.
I'd like to welcome our guest, Anthony Arnov, a good friend and comrade of all of ours here. Anthony has just written and published a book called Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. We know Anthony from just a few months ago when he came out with a book with Howard Zinn, with whom he closely works with. And that book was called Voices of a People's History. I think listeners are familiar with that. Anthony is an editor of one of the finest magazines on the left called International Socialist Review. He's also an editor of Haymarket Books. And if you all get your pencils, we'll tell you how to get a hold of Haymarket Books and the ISR. Before we go on too much lauding Anthony, I just want to say we're very happy to have you here.
Anthony, we were curious. What inspired you to write Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal?
Well, two things, really. I was inspired by a book that Howard Zinn wrote in 1967 called Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. And when I was working at South End Press, an independent publishing house in Boston, in early 2001 and 2002, I had a chance to republish a number of books by Howard Zinn that had gone out of print. And one of those books was Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. It was originally published by Beacon Press and had a really important impact on the movement to end the Vietnam War. Howard was arguing at the time that the only solution was to call for immediate withdrawal, unconditional withdrawal from Vietnam.
What you were pointing to about what liberals think and people saying, well, if we pull out, the place is going to collapse, there'll be more terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. What are really the chief arguments that you make for saying this has to happen right now?
Well, I make a couple of arguments. The first argument I make is that the longer the U.S. stays, the worse things will get. We've seen 3 years now of occupation to back up this assertion. And the longer the U.S. stays, the more the violence increases. Rather than stopping civil war, the United States is actually encouraging sectarian conflict and conditions that are breeding civil war. The United States is making the world a far more dangerous place by being in Iraq and fueling right now a global arms race, including a nuclear arms race, through its presence there. The other thing is that, honestly, the United States has no right to be in Iraq. They used a series of lies to justify a so-called preemptive strike against Iraq, toppling a government that they claimed was a threat to the United States and its allies, a government that they claimed was connected to al-Qaeda, to the attacks of 9/11. That was the lie that was used to sell the idea of destroying the sovereignty of Iraq. All those lies have now been exposed, and every day there's more and more evidence of the mendacity of the argument for the war.
But how do you answer the critics, Anthony?
Yeah.
I mean, the ones who say it's going to get worse. I understand
right.
the position
sure.
that we shouldn't be there and that it's increasing the war, et cetera, and terrorism. But how do you answer the critics that say it's really going to be bad if we leave?
Well, the critics' premise is that the United States is somehow a stabilizing force in Iraq, that they're somehow providing security, a framework for rebuilding the country, a framework for minimizing sectarian conflict. But the reality is that they're doing the opposite. They have been arming Shia militias that have been carrying out sectarian attacks. They've been, through their political interference in the Iraqi constitution and the setting up of political framework in that country, have entrenched sectarian divisions. And they've completely distorted Iraqi society through their presence. There's no way that a government could emerge from the occupation, which is representative of the interests of the Iraqi people, as opposed to representative of the interests of the foreign occupying power, which wants military bases and wants control over Iraqi oil, which puts them in direct conflict with the interests and will of the Iraqi people. So as long as that distorting element is there, it's going to fuel the crisis that we're seeing. There's nothing natural about violence between Sunni and Shia. They intermarried. They lived together. They lived in integrated neighborhoods. It's not as if the U.S. presence is what's stopping horrible things from happening. The U.S. presence is causing horrible things to happen. And the greatest conflict in Iraq today is not between Sunni and Shia or between Arab and Kurd. It's between the occupation and those who are occupied.
For listeners who've just joined us, we have Anthony Arnov in the studio. Anthony is the author of the just-published book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. Anthony, I remember way back when reading Howard Zinn's book, Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. I was active in the anti-war movement in 1967 when that book came out, and that book you credit with being the inspiration for your writing this update on how the American invader should get out of yet another country.
It only took 9 years after that book to get us out, Michael, which doesn't make me feel terrific, Anthony, especially if you're like any kind of prophet here.
And a million Vietnamese lives and 30,000 American lives after you wrote it. But that book was instrumental in winning over a lot of people in the anti-war movement to the position of immediate withdrawal, which is the position all of us here share. But I think that that's not true of the anti-war movement in general. I think there is confusion in the anti-war movement. I think one aspect of that confusion are people in the anti-war movement who support Democratic Party, who supported it when Kerry ran. I think that was, my own view, derailed the anti-war movement. And I wanted to know what your opinion is on whether anti-war activists should be active in or support Democratic Party candidates in the upcoming elections.
Well, I agree with you. I think the anti-war movement made a huge mistake in their support for John Kerry, who is a candidate who was pro-war. He had only tactical differences with the Bush administration, as has the Democratic Party as a whole. They're having a tactical debate over how one occupies another country. There's no good way to occupy another country. The Democratic Party has a long history. We can go back to the role they played in the Vietnam War, but certainly before that, of being a pro-war party. And the anti-war movement needs to maintain its independence from the Democrats and the Republicans. They need to maintain their financial, their political independence. And we need to see our task as putting pressure on both major parties, or both wings of the one major party, which is really what I think they are. And we're going to need to do that if we're going to get the troops out of Iraq.
Talk to us about the occupation. What do Americans not know that's happening on a day-to-day basis?
There's so much that we don't know that's not being shown on television, that's not being put on the front page of our newspapers, that's not being talked about on the radio, except on independent radio like Pacifica and WBAI. And the reality is that every day the occupation uses practices of racism and humiliation against the Iraqi people. Every day the occupation is engaging in collective punishment against the Iraqi people. And more, it's adopting a model borrowed from Israeli treatment of the Palestinians, borrowed from what's called the El Salvador strategy, counterinsurgency methods that were used in Latin America. This involves tremendous violence. It means that today there are 14,000 Iraqis who are being detained. Abu Ghraib is not some isolated incident. It's part of a broader system of secret prisons, of torture. Some 50,000 Iraqis have gone through the detention system. Some people have been held 1-2 years without any trial, any due process, any way of contesting their claims. In some cases, their families have no idea if they're even alive because they don't know where they're being held. Unemployment has skyrocketed. People are afraid to send their children to school. People are afraid to leave their homes. People are leaving neighborhoods that were formerly integrated, Sunni, Shia, and so on, to seek some refuge from the violence that has been encouraged by this occupation.
We have with us Anthony Arnov, who has recently published the book Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal by New Press. And if you get your pencils, we'll tell you how to get it. Anthony Arnov is one of the editors of the International Socialist Review. He's on the editorial staff of Haymarket Books. he's written just this extremely helpful book when it comes to the anti-war movement educating itself about what's going on in Iraq and how we can get out of there. We're very happy to have Anthony here in the studios. Dahlia, you had...
Well, why should people who are already against the war get this book and read it?
Well, I think this book is for those people who either themselves have questions about whether or not the United States can withdraw troops or find themselves in conversation with or argument with people. And I think that applies to everyone in the anti-war movement.
It's clear that all of our U.S. troops ought to be taken out, but we can't stop there. I mean, we've built a 300,000-square-foot embassy, which I think is the biggest in the world, and we have at least four permanent military bases that are gigantic and probably skew more. So your argument is not just that our troops have to get out, I presume. It's really something farther than that, isn't it?
Absolutely. I make the argument that we need to end the economic strangulation of Iraq, which has gone hand in hand with this occupation, and we need to remove U.S. military bases. There's talk of as many as 14 military bases being set up in Iraq, but certainly four large facilities that the United States is now negotiating with the interim government that it helped manipulate and shape and bring into power so that they'll agree to long-term basing rights, overflight rights, and so on. We need to end that.
Even if we get the demand and actually get American troops out of there, you don't just want to leave a neo-colonial state, essentially, which is what we will have if we don't actually extirpate all of this.
Absolutely. And I would add to that, we as an anti-war movement need to address the very immediate threat that the United States is now posing to Iran. They hoped to use Iraq as a base for projection of military power, political power in the Middle East. We recall, if you go back to the Vietnam War, the expansion of the war into Laos and Cambodia, even after 1968, when the U.S. militarily was effectively defeated by the Vietnamese resistance. They're very seriously escalating the threat against Iran right now. So I think we have to link it as well to a broader picture of what the United States is doing in the Middle East, what the U.S. is doing in the world. This is not some aberration. This is a symptom of U.S. imperialism, not an isolated mistake.
Howard Zinn wrote both the preface as well as the afterword.
The
afterword of the book. And, of course, I've heard Howard speak, and he talks about essentially a permanent war in the United States, that the United States is carrying on permanent war for the last, generations.
Absolutely.
And that's, I think that's why you don't want to see Iraq as just isolated from that, just as we shouldn't have seen Vietnam as isolated from that.
Absolutely.
That we beat Iraq, we'll still be marching in 40 more years against something else unless we change the very nature of this society.
Yeah, you go back to Martin Luther King in the Riverside Church speech of April 4th, 1967, and he's talking about protesting the war in Vietnam, and he says, we don't want to be here as clergy and laity concerned about the war against Latin America, the war against countries in Africa. But we will be unless we address the twin evils of racism, economic exploitation, and war, and get at the root of what drives these imperial adventures of the United States.
One thing you mentioned, Anthony, when you were talking about reasons for immediate withdrawal was nuclear race. Now, can you explain that a little bit? You mentioned that, but that you said it would increase really the world's jeopardy from nuclear bombs.
Sure. Well, most countries around the world look at Iraq and they see that Iraq, a sovereign state, had its regime toppled and it was invaded not because it had weapons of mass destruction, but because it didn't. It didn't have a credible deterrent to U.S. power. And there's now a race of countries to develop a deterrent to U.S. power, including nuclear deterrent. Certainly Iran realizes that. Russia realizes that. Putin just gave a State of the Union speech in which he said, you know, we're not going to allow the United States to trample us underfoot, and we're going to have to develop the kind of weapons technology that can counter them. There's a new arms race, he said. They may not want to be in that arms race. That's a different question. But certainly countries are engaged in an arms race, and it's not just nuclear weapons. It's a whole new generation of weapons, including weapons in space, including low-yield nuclear weapons, and new forms of missiles. Each one of these things has a multiplier effect and is profoundly destabilizing.
I think that point about Iraq is really crucial, that even if we were to withdraw right away, I mean, basically the point has unfortunately been established that the U.S. will invade you unless you have a weapon of mass destruction that can stop them.
And,
serious business.
And the new National Security Strategy document of the United States, which updates the one that was published in September 2002 that laid the groundwork for the invasion of Iraq, the new document not only reasserts the right of preemptive strikes against other countries, which a number of people felt should have been questioned after the invasion of Iraq. But it also uses the same language about Iran that it used about Iraq in the last document. And you see a script which is being played out right now, which is leading towards a very, very dangerous and potential nuclear conflict in the region.
One other parallel you brought up about the current situation was the comparison to El Salvador, which is, you know, I read sort of vaguely about it. The Shiite government apparently is in some way financing involved with the death squads in Iraq. And, of course, it brings up exactly as you said. Salvador, that was really the hammer of the right-wing government in El Salvador. That really is what eliminated the progressive movement or attempted to eliminate it in El Salvador. Can you just talk about that a little bit in Iraq?
There's people right now who are essentially advocating a strategy. Thomas Friedman, for example, I quote him in the book, the New York Times columnist. He said, we should arm the Kurds, arm the Shia, and let the Sunni reap the wind. That's his expression, reap the wind. Well, what does that mean? That means we should foment civil war in order that the people who are allied with us and who could potentially form a new government will violently crush the Sunnis. The Wall Street Journal ran an op-ed a couple of weeks ago by an analyst at the American Enterprise Institute in which he said we need to engage in a pacification campaign in Baghdad. Now, recall that Baghdad is the greatest population center in Iraq. Millions of people live there, integrated city. We should engage in pacification campaign even though it will lead to, quote-unquote, skyrocketing body counts. So there's an understanding that the United States has lost control of the situation in Iraq as they lost control of the situation in Vietnam. And rather than pull back, there's many people within the administration who are arguing intensify counterinsurgency operations, intensify pacification, a word that has echoes with Vietnam as well, arm Shia militias. And some of the militias are not only operating independently with arms that have been supplied by the United States, but are operating through the Iraqi Interior Ministry with government sanction and protection of a government uniform.
Right, and that's actually the Interior Ministry that had the secret torture prison underneath it. It's interesting, Thomas Friedman's quote is actually, the biblical quote is sow the wind and reap the whirlwind.
Yes.
But anyway, he misquoted it a bit.
Anthony, in your book you talk about corporate involvement and the harm done to the Iraqi people.
There's a reconstruction racket which is taking place.
I mean, it's a windfall. It's, you know, Beltway bandits are, I mean, it's unreal.
No bid, no compete contracts, cost plus contracts, which means the more they can build into a contract, the more these companies like Halliburton can get, Kellogg, Brown & Root, and so on. Evidence of massive corruption, yet no harm to the companies, no punishment to the companies. They keep getting more contracts. All of the projects that they claimed that they were going to engage in terms of hospitals, schools, water supply, electricity, almost none of them have come to fruition. There's less electricity in Iraq now than there was before the invasion, which is under sanctions, which is a phenomenal condemnation of the occupation. Less access to safe drinking water. Iraqis almost universally say that things are worse now than they were under Saddam Hussein. It's phenomenal. And yet billions of dollars being spent. Where is it going? It's going to line the pockets of some of these corporations. It's going, in some cases, to private mercenaries operating in a completely gray area of international law, which is, you know, another element of the whole defining down of torture that the Bush administration has been engaged in and that Michael has written so importantly about. And a clear example of corporate looting. There's also another just outrageous fact, which is Iraqis are paying hijacked prices for oil, which is being imported from other countries, even though they have the world's second largest oil reserves through some of these contracts, where these companies like Halliburton are bringing in oil from Jordan and raising the price drastically. What a condemnation of the occupation.
We're speaking with Anthony Arnov, the author of the just-published book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. If people will get their pens or pencils, I want to tell you how to get it. It's published by New Press. Another fine publishing house is Haymarket Books. Anthony is associated with them. That's at www.haymarketbooks.org. You can look that up. And Anthony is going to be speaking at the Socialism 2006 conference here in New York City from June 22nd to 25th. Not only Anthony, but a bunch of really interesting speakers. Jeremy Scale is going to be there, David Zirin, the sports writer, Etan Thomas, the basketball player for the Washington Wizards. A terrific conference, June 22nd to 25th. And Anthony will be speaking about his book. And you can get more information on that conference by going to socialismconference.org. So, Anthony Arnov, it's very nice to have you here.
What do you hope that your book will achieve?
Well, I would be happy if it helped contribute in any way to a strengthening of an anti-war movement that can push for immediate withdrawal. And I hope I can provide some clarity that can lead to more effective organizing around this very, very crucial war. It's not just crucial that we end this occupation for the Iraqi people. I think it's crucial for us and for the world.
The state of the anti-war movement right now, after the last book, when Zinn wrote it, as we said, it took 9 years to get out of Vietnam after the logic of withdrawal in Vietnam, and now it's the logic of withdrawal in Iraq. How do you see the next period of time in terms of the building of the anti-war movement, the getting out of Iraq? What are the key principles you would say should guide it?
I see some very encouraging developments, first of all. Right now, there's a group called Iraq Veterans Against the War, which is tremendously important. Group, which is organizing veterans, in some cases kids who can't vote, can't drink, who have fought in Iraq and are back in this country speaking out against the war. We have conscientious objectors like Camilo Mejia and Pablo Paredes who have been giving an eloquent voice to those soldiers who have seen what's happening in Iraq, see the contradictions between the stories that they would be liberating Iraqis and what they were actually being compelled to do. And who are also giving voice to a very important part of our anti-war movement. And you go back to the Vietnam War, it was a decisive feature of the anti-war movement that there was a GI rebellion. It's not talked about that often, but there's a tremendous book about that by David Courtwright called Soldiers in Revolt that Haymarket published, and a new film called Sir, No Sir, which everyone
is great.
Has to see.
Amazing.
It corrects so many myths about the Vietnam War movement, and it shows the leading role that soldiers played in ending that war. So I'm encouraged that organization, that voice is being heard. I'm also encouraged by the impact that the counter-recruitment movement has had. The military is facing a serious shortfall in recruitment. Particularly, they've had a sharp decline in African-American and Latino recruits. And that's important because people are beginning to make connections between racism at home, the war on immigrants and the poor in this country, and what's happening in Iraq. And that was a vital element of the Vietnam War movement. Part of what helped spur and spark the rebellion of GIs in Vietnam was the civil rights movement at home, people making those kinds of connections of the racism used against the Vietnamese and the racism used against home and, of course, the racism against soldiers. So I'm encouraged that right now military recruiters are on the defensive.
I mean, they're getting desperate. That we were talking to some kids last week who work with other kids of color, and they were saying that in the junior high schools in their area, military recruiters hang out on the sidewalk outside the junior high schools. We spoke with some other kids. This was at the Amnesty International Conference where Jeff Brady, our producer, and I were talking to a bunch of folks. And some other kids were saying that the military is producing video games for kids.
Absolutely. I mean, they're spending more money. They're having to increase the lies that they tell. They're having to increase the economic incentives, although most soldiers never actually get the benefit of those promises because there's so many strings attached and so few people actually end up qualifying for those benefits. But yeah, they're getting desperate. And I'm also encouraged by the example that the immigrants' rights movement has given to the anti-war movement of the power of protest. I think elements of the anti-war movement kind of gave up on the idea that we need to be in the streets. The immigrant rights movement, in the couple of weeks of being in the streets, has transformed the nature of the debate in this country. And we could learn a lot from what they've been doing. We shouldn't see those as counterpost struggles. They're the same struggle, and they can each lend support to the other.
Yeah, several weeks ago we were out at an anti-torture protest in Portland, Oregon, and this woman, we spoke to this woman who was there who had just quit her job to protest full-time against the war in Iraq. She said, "My brother is over there now, and if he dies, I'll just lose my mind. This is the moment. This is the time. If I don't quit my job and devote myself to this fully, I will never have the opportunity to go back and correct that mistake."
It's very powerful. I think a lot of people are sensing that this is the moment. The thing is, I think we just need to find ways of effectively channeling that. And to get back to Michael's point, I think there's a number of things that as an anti-war movement we can be doing. I wouldn't focus on the midterm elections or getting the Democrats elected. They're not going to be the standard bearer of the anti-occupation message. But I would focus on counter-recruitment, on lending support to those soldiers who are speaking out, who are declaring conscientious objection, to those organizations that are organizing veterans and soldiers. And I certainly would be looking for ways of building grassroots connections to the immigrant rights movement and to struggles that are happening in communities around this country where the costs of the war are coming home, the economic costs of the war, the social costs, and also the costs in terms of our civil liberties.
Anthony Arnov, author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, available through New Press. We thank you so much for joining us. And I have a little gift for you. We want to give you Neil Young's CD, Living with War. And we're going to let you play a song for the listeners. What would you like to play?
Thank you. Why don't we go out with Let's Impeach the President?
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great, Anthony.
It's a great book. Go get it, readers, listeners, etc.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law & Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Law & Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
Justice.